This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
It takes a long time to research and report findings in a scientific journal. So after all that work, you think those scientists would be good at actually writing the reports?
Many study reports do not include that essential information.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about STARD, a statement of standards for scientific reporting and how they're being updated. We'll also hear about the lights being used to study Lake Champlain, learn about efforts to save a dying language in the Northwest, and spend an academic minute exploring your inner feelings about the United Nations. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Incomplete reporting in scientific papers is a major source of needless waste of time and resources in biomedical research. Essential information is not often provided in study reports, hindering the identification, critical appraisal, and confirmation of the work presented. So in 2003, the Standards for the Reporting of Diagnostic Accuracy Studies, or STARD statement and guidelines, were developed and published in many scientific journals. Since the initial publication of STARD, several assessments have pointed to small but significant improvements in reporting accuracy studies. More of the essential items are being reported, but the situation remains far from ideal. So over the past few years, the STARD group has remained active in assessing progress and has updated their recommendations in STARD 2015 with a list of 30 essential items that should be included in every report of a diagnostic accuracy study. The new STARD checklist appeared in the December 2015 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry, as well as a number of other journals. The lead author of the STARD statement is Dr. Patrick Basut. He is professor of clinical epidemiology and head of the School of Public Health at the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. I spoke to Dr. Basut and asked him, basically, what is the STARD statement?
The STARD is an abbreviation that stands for Standards for Reporting Diagnostic Accuracy Studies. And it's a list of items that should be included in every report of a study that report diagnostic accuracy. So what's diagnostic accuracy? So diagnostic accuracy is an expression of the performance of an imaging test or another medical test, like its sensitivity and its specificity. So it expresses how well the test can identify people with and without a specific disease.
Talk about the development of STARD. Why was this developed and has it needed any updating?
It was developed because study reports of a sensitivity and the specificity of an imaging test or another test should not only include these numbers, the sensitivity itself and the specificity, but they should also include how the study was done. And that's essential because you can do a study in a right way and you could do it in a wrong way. And readers should be able to find out whether the results are valid. Now, that's not just about validity. There's also applicability. Readers should be able to learn whether the study was done in adults or in young people, and whether it was done in people in the developed world or maybe in Asia. And that's necessary to evaluate the applicability of the study findings to the specific situation of the reader. Now, STARD was developed because many study reports do not include that essential information. They do not tell us how the study was done in sufficient detail. Actually, the reports do not tell us in what kind of patients actually the study was done. Now, to encourage and to facilitate more complete reporting, we developed STARD initially in 2003 to encourage readers to be more complete and more transparent in the reporting of these studies. So if authors go through the list of the items that we have developed, they can be guaranteed that their study report contains all of the essential information for readers. Now, that was not the case before 2003, when we initially developed STAR, and it still was not the case last year when we looked at how well STAR was implemented. So that's why we developed an update, and the updates include a couple of new items, and it also re-expresses, formulates the items in a slightly different way that we hope make the list easier to use.
Doctor, it's now been a dozen years since the initial STARD report was published. What has been its impact?
That's a very relevant question, because why make such a list if it doesn't produce an effect? Several studies have now compared the completeness of reporting before the development of STARD and after STARD has been released and included in instructions of authors in multiple journals. And these evaluations have shown that the introduction of STARD has resulted in a slightly more complete reporting. So authors that have used STARD are able to produce study reports that are more informative, more complete, contain more of the essential information. But overall, the improvement has been relatively modest. It's statistically significant, so more things are now included in study reports, but the improvement is still relatively minor. And that was one of the other reasons for developing STAR 215, to make the list easier to use so that more authors and more reviewers and more editors can use STAR to make sure that the study reports are fully informative and helpful for readers.
Is this the only tool of this kind available to help authors?
No, definitely not, actually. When authors prepare manuscripts, there are many instruments to help them. So every journal has a list of instructions for authors that tell authors how to write manuscripts that are fit for purpose, fit for publication in a journal. But these instructions are mostly technical. They tell authors how to format the references and things like that. So for specific types of studies, several groups have developed reporting guidelines. One of the first to be developed actually were the CONSORT guidelines for randomized clinical trials. So if you compare a treatment and intervention against an alternative, you can use the CONSORT reporting guideline to make sure that your study report is fully informative. And CONSORT was the first, but there are now over 100 different reporting guidelines for all kinds of specific study types, for genetic studies, for observational studies, for meta-analysis, and so on. And the Equator Initiative is a resource for these reporting guidelines. So on the Equator website, you can find reporting guidelines for other studies. Now, radiology has been a strong promoter of complete and transparent reporting. So we know, actually, that on average, the studies reported in radiology are more informative and more complete than in some of the competing journals, some of the other journals in the same field. And we hope that the development of STARD 215 will further help the completeness and informativeness of study reports, especially for the studies that have evaluated the performance of medical tests.
Well, finally, Dr. Pursuit, we've talked about how STARD helps authors and helps journal editors. How will it help readers?
Well, it can help readers in a couple of ways. One is an indirect way and the other is a direct way. If radiology adopts STARD 215, that will mean that the authors can use a list of items to verify that their study report is fully informative and therefore fit for publication in the journal. It also means that the reviewers will use STARD to verify that a manuscript has all the essential information. And if some of the elements are missing, reviewers for radiology can point out to the authors that information is missing, and they can invite the authors to include the missing information. So the indirect result will be that readers have more informative, more complete, more helpful publications about the performance of new imaging tests, and elsewhere in medicine, more informative publications of medical tests in general. But readers can also use STARD in a direct way. If they want to make sure that an individual manuscript contains all of the essential information, they can go through the list of 30 STARD items, and if they do so, if they check the manuscript to see where that information is available, they will have a very, very good impression about what the study actually did, whether or not the results were valid, what the actual results were, and whether the results can apply to the reader's own situation, whether the results are applicable to the decision problem that the reader actually had when turning to the manuscript, when turning to the article to find the answers. So there's an indirect way through better manuscripts through the reviewing process, and a direct way, a direct use of STARD when reading articles about the sensitivity and the specificity of new or existing antigen tests.
Dr. Patrick Bisout is professor of clinical epidemiology and head of the School of Public Health at the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Do you remember Light Bright? It was a toy with small colored plastic pegs that created illuminated designs on a light board. Well, scientists and designers have taken that concept to a new level. They've created a display at the Echo Center for Lake Champlain in Burlington, Vermont, to visually display data about the lake. The best of our knowledge's Pat Bradley has more.
More than 7,500 LED lights dangle at the entry of the Echo Lake Science Center in a 12-foot by 12-foot by 6-foot cube. Each bulb can be individually programmed to create a visual representation of Lake Champlain data, including temperature, storms, algae blooms, and more. As people gather on the second floor to observe the display, Lake Bright project manager Rachel Hooper describes the visualization lighting up in front of them.
This is a cutting-edge installation. This is the only piece that exists that is a 3D data visualization platform, and it's right here on Burlington's waterfront. Let's start with the August 4th Doppler scan storm. So we're looking at radar data just moving through this cube. As you can see, it was a really rapid storm.
Hooper says Lake Bright is an effort to bring data to people in a way that is fun and sparks curiosity.
Right now in the early stages, what we're playing with are all of the metrics that are gathered in the 15 different stations around Lake Champlain. Things like temperature over time, phosphorus, nutrient data, clarity of the water, all things that when you put them together start to paint a picture of the health of Lake Champlain.
Echo Executive Director Phelan Fretz says within a few months, interactive kiosks will be placed both inside and outside the facility to help the public understand the data visualizations.
We're opening a platform for communicating important information, data visualizations about Lake Champlain. This is the first installation in the country.
Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources Dean and Professor Nancy Matthews is excited to see the new data visualization tool.
This is a cool idea. And imagine all the data that you could gather on the lake ecosystem in Lake Champlain, from water quality to fish behavior to invertebrates to the influence of precipitation and climate change, and try to make sense out of that. And for big data, we need new and innovative techniques to help us visualize and understand these patterns.
Senator Patrick Leahy was among those mesmerized by the display.
I get more excited every time I come here because of the innovation. But the thing that excites me the most is watching the young people who get excited. We can sometimes forget that this is all a learning process. This and what Google and everybody else has done helps with that learning process.
Google is funding Lake Bright. Google Analytics evangelist Justin Cutroni says they were seeking a cutting-edge project that intersects art and science.
Look at this thing. It's 24 feet wide, it's 9 feet tall, it's 6 feet deep. That's 1,300 cubic feet of light. Lake Bright can bring data visualization to the entire community, and more importantly, information about the health of our lake.
One of those watching the display asked if the visualization methods could be used to study the human body or be used in other applications. Cutroni says this project, the first of its kind in the world, is in its initial phases, but they can already imagine other applications.
Data now is ubiquitous in every discipline, right? Whether it's figuring out traffic or medicine or education. So there's no shortage of data. Obviously, having lake data is wonderful because it's something that's right here and very relevant to this building and its mission. But we're excited that this could be a way to visualize lots of different types of information.
Reporting for the best of our knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
Still to come, teachers from the Northwest are trying to save a dying language. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Linguists say that by the end of the century, 80% of all world languages will fall out of use. The spread of global languages like English and Spanish has made learning regional languages less useful. But some speakers of these languages are trying to change that. From the series Radioactive, Ben Gald investigates one speaker trying to prevent her language from vanishing.
This is Lushootseed. It's a language spoken by many tribes in the Puget Sound region, such as the Muckleshoot and Puyallup. It's been around for hundreds of years, but it's in danger of going extinct. Only a few tribal leaders are fluent in Lushootseed. It's a hard language to learn.
Like, you hear people saying how amazing it is that you can speak it, how they wish they could, but they don't have the time.
This is Maria Martin, a teacher at the Tulalip Montessori School. The school offers classes in Lushootseed to children ages 3 through 5. She worries that the language she loves could disappear.
That's definitely one of my worst fears, is that it dies out and that nobody speaks it anymore, because that's a big part of who we are. And to lose that, it just seems that much easier to lose everything else.
When a language dies, more than just words stop being spoken. Stories stop being told. Songs stop being sung. Preserving cultural values and history is much harder without a way to share them.
How are you going to sing songs you don't know the meanings to? How are you going to provide any traditional connections, like, without the language? I feel you need to know the language, if only some of it, to really understand the whole culture.
She believes if Lushootseed is going to survive, it must carry on in the voices of youth. This is Maria's classroom. Today the children are learning how to count to 10. The lessons in Lushootseed provide a way for the kids to experience their cultural heritage, which they couldn't find in most preschools. Maria says the response from the parents and the community has been overwhelmingly positive.
You'll see video posts on Facebook, and it'll be their kids singing a Lushootseed song, or, you know, telling them some words in Lushootseed. And so you see that pride of the parents that, hey, my child knows this, that's something to be celebrated.
When Maria was a child, she attended the same school. She thinks that her time there has made her more in touch with her culture.
I hope to be the inspiration that some of my teachers were to me when I was growing up. I was lucky enough to start out in Montessori and learn some Lushootseed, but after I left Montessori, I didn't get much exposure. Like, it wasn't offered in school anymore.
Teaching the language in preschool is a good start, but Maria says that much more work needs to be done. The Tulalip tribes are working to train more teachers and get language programs into higher levels of school. But it's going to take more than just that. If the language is going to remain relevant, it must adapt to the changing lifestyles of its speakers.
Technology has changed. Words are now being used, so we're having to create new words for modern life. And in doing so, that's going to help preserve the language.
This is David Cinco. He's not a native tribe member, but he has been working with the Tulalip tribes for the past 10 years as a media developer. Basically, he's in charge of all the technological aspects of the tribes. Managing the website, creating weather forecasts in Lushootseed, anything that helps to reconcile the language with the technology of today. For example,
Takad ti suf chutlab
means turn off the TV, and
Ha'alik ched ati suf ail ali
means I am typing on the computer. David is confident that Lushootseed won't be extinct anytime soon.
All the Lushootseed-speaking tribes are really putting a concerted effort, and they are starting to work together more readily. So I see that that is not going to be a problem in the Puget Sound region.
Ultimately, it's up to the next generation to keep Lushootseed alive. After all, that's why Maria does this work.
The kids, they inspire me to get up every day to come into work. Next year, they might go on to kindergarten and forget all about me. But for that little bit, there was something there. And maybe they'll have the chance to take away what I took away.
For Radioactive, I'm Ben Gald.
Saving a language is a job for linguists. Saving the countries those languages come from, well, that's probably a job for the United Nations. And how you feel about the UN just happens to be the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Do Americans feel favorably toward the United Nations? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Martin Edwards, associate professor in the School of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University, describes his research into our feelings toward the world governing body and what our responses say about our country's interests in the future.
The United Nations is marking its 70th anniversary this year with an ambitious agenda, including new development goals for all countries and a recent climate change summit. What do Americans think about the United Nations? Working with a team of students, I evaluated findings from a survey of registered voters that was conducted last year by the Better World campaign. Overall, 58% of those surveyed gave the UN favorable ratings. This favorability rating was higher than the president's and more than twice as high as that of Congress. We analyzed the reasons that were given by respondents to explain why they gave the UN the favorability rating that they did. We learned the support for the UN is diffuse and objections to the UN are specific. Respondents that had favorable views of the UN focused on its ability to solve global problems or to serve as a forum for diplomats to talk. So they answered why the UN is a good thing in general without much detail. Respondents with unfavorable views of the UN, on the other hand, tended to make a more specific argument that working with the UN was harmful to U.S. interests. They described the UN's membership as hostile toward the U.S. and that the U.S. was not getting enough return from its financial support of the UN. So while supporters did not talk about specific benefits for the U.S. from engagement with the UN, the opponents were much more concrete. More research is clearly necessary to better understand the sources of attitudes about the United Nations. These findings suggest that one factor that shapes opinions is not demographic factors such as who the respondents are, but rather how the respondents think.
That was Martin Edwards of Seton Hall University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.